And we have a very special guest today coming to us from Texas. And this guest is well known to many, many, many of you. As a matter of fact, I hear this name all the time, not just on my traveling circuit, not just when I walk into the bookstores to look at books that I've written, but I hear it right on the street. This is a man whose name is Household Word, and you'll recognize him, and you're going to learn a lot from him in the next hour. With me today, I have Dr. Kenneth Cooper, M.D., Master in Public Health, and the founder and director of the Cooper Clinic. Dr. Cooper, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, John. It's a real pleasure.
Tell me, you know, like I was telling you before we started this show, you're an inspiration to me. How in the world did you ever get this started? I mean, you must have been a real maverick many years back.
That's the understatement of the day. 21 years ago, when I established the Aerobic Center in Dallas, I had two employees at a two-room office. At the present time, we have a 30-acre state and 220 employees, and some 57,000 people have come to this clinic one up to 20 times over the last 21 years. But as you predicted, it was very controversial during those early years because I was limiting my practice to taking care of healthy people, not taking care of sick people. Even my supportive colleagues, and there weren't many back in those days, said there is no way you can limit your practice of medicine to taking care of healthy people. Make ends meet. People do not see their physicians when they're well. They see their physicians when they're sick. Well, we've grown from that small two-room office to this large campus, and wonder why. Why have we been so successful with the prediction of such doom?
Yeah, tell me.
I think the answer is this answer, really, John, that I didn't realize, that my supportive colleagues realized, that if people understand they have a need, you provide a service, they get the results they want, they'll make you successful. And that's the key to our success.
People have come to your clinic and they've gotten healthier, though. You say they're healthy when they come, but I mean they leave even healthier and with better ideas.
That's right. We concentrate on lifestyle changing. And what has made us successful, too, is this fact. It's a whole lot cheaper and more effective to maintain good health than to regain it once it's lost. Time after time, we pick up disease early before it causes symptoms. Just this morning, a patient from Wichita Falls called and said, Doc, you were right. Resting EKG was normal. Stress test, grossly abnormal. It was so bad, I insisted that he have a coronary arteriogram done. And one of the major blood vessels supplying blood to his heart was 99% obstructed. The guy would probably have died within 6 to 8 weeks if he hadn't had the stress test. And that's why the most common first symptom of severe underlying heart disease is sudden death. And I'm convinced we can drop that statistic down tremendously if people just have an examination when they're well, not when they're sick.
So what kind of examination would you recommend to people who are well? Say we're talking about a 40-year-old man walking around with a little bit of a pot belly, no idea of his blood pressure, no idea of his cholesterol, thinking that he's invulnerable, thinking that nothing could ever happen to him. What do you do with a person like that?
Well, again, the four steps as far as any preventive medicine program to be successful are number one, evaluation. Number two, education and motivation. Number three is implementation. Number four is reevaluation. That's the basic guidelines we give them. What about the evaluation? Well, we do a very comprehensive examination here in a one-day period. People come in the night before, stay at our hotel, and they go to the clinic the next day. And a lot of these people, by the way, John, are corporate executives because they found that physical fitness is good business for them and for their employees. But the examination consists primarily of cardiovascular screening and cancer screening. For the women, we do mammographies. For the men, we do colonoscopies. We do proctoscopies. We do x-rays, our stress test. We do percent body fat determination. Of course, that's the extreme. You might ask, well, what can I do? What's the best thing? What's the best return on my investment? What can I do that would give me the best return on my money? I would say the stress test and the cancer screen are the two most important things we do that have the potential of prolonging lives. Keep in mind that resting EKG picks up single vessel coronary obstructive disease in only about 15 to 17% of the cases. A maximal performance treadmill stress test, the type we do here with computer analysis now to increase the accuracy, runs at least 85% accurate, John. And I'll tell you, those are the people whose lives we're saving. Look at the cases that we pick up, cancers in the breast with mammography, as small as a period at the end of a sentence. The majority of those cases, we can cure those people. Look at the over 500 patients we picked up early polyps in the colon by a simple proctoscopy exam, and a high percentage of those would eventually become malignant. A lot of those cancers, a lot of those polyps already are malignant. Well, those are lives that are saved, too. It's just on and on, but cancer screening, cardiovascular screening, that's the way we're saving lives.
Well, Dr. Kenneth Cooper, I hate to be conflicting in this thing, but these areas that you mentioned are quite controversial, are they not? I mean, screening asymptomatic men and women with a treadmill stress test has been evaluated many times, and the results have been there is not, as I understand, a decrease in chance of dying of heart disease by screening asymptomatic people. And as far as removing polyps, again, we're dealing with an area where hopefully we would get a reduction in cancer and a prolongation of life. But nobody's shown that by scientific study. And mammography is something we could probably talk about the whole hour. Has a lot more controversy associated with it than the American public are aware of. Is this not true?
Well, again, anything that I say, you can find to the opposite of the scientific literature, but you have to weigh the odds. Do you want to take that chance? What about that woman that we pick up that malignancy at 35, 40 years of age in the very earliest stages? From what I read, I can give that chance, that woman, up to 95% chance of surviving for 20 years if I can pick up that disease at that stage. But to the contrary, if she finds malignancy, as most women do, by palpating her own breast and a radical mastectomy carries with it only a 60% chance of surviving for 5 years. Those are facts, too. I'll play the odds. Look at stress testing. What you're talking about is the prolonged history of false positive versus false negatives. For years, I have felt that it's not the stress test that's at fault. It's the stress tester who is at fault. Improperly administered stress testing using latest computer technology can be very accurate as compared with such things as thallium scans. Now, we're using PET scans, John, to try to have something intervening before the coronary arteriogram to compare with our stress test. So I'm saying that using modern technology, I really feel that we can eliminate a lot of the criticism, a lot of the bias of some of these tests that have been performed in the past, because of the techniques which are being used to administer the test.
And certainly they're great motivators. I mean, somebody who is confronted with their mortality in terms of flunking a treadmill stress test or having something suspicious on a mammogram is likely to take account of their diet and lifestyle, and I have no doubt that you perform great service on that basis. As I understand it, Dr. Kenneth Cooper, when you first started your studies and your clinic, we're looking at 16 years ago?
Oh, no, 21 years ago.
Your main interest was primarily exercise, but as time has gone on, the rumors that I hear, you have gotten a lot more interested in the dietary issues.
Oh, yeah, I changed my concepts considerably in 1982 when I published Aerobics Pro for Total Well-Being. As you may recall from my first book, Aerobics, published in 1968, I made this statement, that exercise overcomes many, if not all, of the deleterious effects of diet. And I thought if you exercised enough, that would compensate for a bad diet. But to the contrary, over the next 14 years, it was brought to my attention more than once, usually by distraught widows, who told me that their husband followed my exercise recommendations exactly. But he ignored his diet, his weight, his cigarette smoking habits, and died of a heart attack at 55 years of age. So obviously, there's more to a wellness program than just exercise. And you'll find in my writings after 1982, I emphasize six things as basic parts of a wellness program. Not just an exercise program, but a wellness program. Number one is proper weight, proper diet, proper nutrition. Number two is proper exercise. Number three, the elimination of tobacco, particularly cigarette smoking. Number four, the control of alcohol, elimination of habit-forming drugs. Number five, stress management techniques. And number six, the importance of the periodic wellness examination. So you can see we've really expanded our concept. For example, John, when a person comes to this clinic, they bring with them a three-day diary of all the foods they've consumed. Now, again, with computer technology, we analyze the diet while they're here, and then one of our three full-time nutritionists sits down and works with that person, looking at percent body fat as determined by underwater weighing or by skin fold measurements, looking at the blood lipid profile that's determined while they're here, and we get those results back in about an hour, and then looking at the nutritional evaluation by computer technology. And then in a very sophisticated manner, that nutritionist can tell that patient what they need to do to correct their deficiencies. That's modern preventive medicine.
And, of course, that, as you and I well know, is what really works. As you say, it's better to prevent it than to try and treat it after it's already happened. In reading over the literature that I see here and also realizing you're a man who changes based upon the scientific literature that comes out, let me just ask you. There was recently a Center for the Science and the Public Interest poll where they went around and they asked famous people like Dr. Ernst Winder, like Dr. Frank Sachs, and so on, people involved in good health, on diet and lifestyle. They asked them, excluding all other issues, whether people like the food or don't like the food, excluding what it would do to the economics of this country and so on, what would you say is the ideal diet for people who want to reduce their risk of cancer and heart disease to the absolute minimum? And I'd like to ask you that, Dr. Kenneth Cooper. What is the best diet that people could eat to reduce their risk of health problems to the absolute minimum, regardless of whether you and I like the food or not?
Okay, let's look at those individuals. Let's look at cancer first. I would say the diet that I recommend in my books, particularly diets like controlling cholesterol, when I published that book in 1988, the Aerobics Program Total Well-Being, published in 1982, that we try to get our people to consume 50 to 60% complex carbohydrates, 15% protein, and 25 to 30% fat daily. And we recommend that they break the fat down to roughly 10% model, 10% poly, and 10% saturated. Why do I recommend saturated fat? Well, John, we've noticed in our studies that if people completely eliminate fat from their diet, almost invariably the total cholesterol goes down, but so does the HDL, and not uncommonly the ratio increases. And we don't want that. We want the ratio to go down, so I found adding a little saturated fat to an almost a vegetarian type of diet many times enables the person to increase his HDL cholesterol. We also want that cholesterol to be less than 300 milligrams per day. All right, let's compare that dietary recommendation with their Pritikin type diet, which is more like 80% complex carbohydrate, 10% protein, 10% fat, and less than 100 milligrams of cholesterol daily. How do we compare? Well, we have people that come down here and stay with us for 13 days, just like they do at the Pritikin Institute and other places around the country. And we find that in 13 days, our people lose on the average 8 pounds on this type of a diet, of course, adjusting calories too, but they'll drop their cholesterol by 13% using the diet we give them. That's about what they get with the Pritikin approach. So I'm saying you don't have to be as dramatic or as radical to get a significant reduction in cholesterol, plus the fact we're giving people a diet they can live with for the rest of their lives. Most people won't stay on a Pritikin type of diet. So we're very emphatic on our diet. We do get good results. I do believe that 75% of the patients that we see with elevated cholesterol and abnormal blood lipids that we can control with weight loss, dietary restriction, and exercise. And the other 25%, I'll use medications to lower their lipids if necessary. That's cardiovascular disease. What about cancer? Well, I'm getting more and more impressed that if we can reduce the free radicals in the blood, that we probably can reduce the incidence of cancer and probably arteriosclerosis. One of the latest theories, I'm sure as you know, is that the LDL must be oxygenated before it deposits in the vessels, and you must have the free radicals to be able to oxygenate the LDL or bad cholesterol to make it deposit. Well, you need some type of antioxidant daily in order to keep the free radicals down. What do you need? Vitamin C, 1,000 milligrams a day. Vitamin E, 400 international units per day. A beta-carotene. Some of those antioxidants can be used to keep the free radicals down. I'm also convinced that there's enough data to show that the cruciferous vegetables in the diet are of value in reducing cancer. I remember that by two B's and two C's, and that's broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cauliflower and cabbage. Cruciferous vegetables seem to be related to reduction of cancer. So those are just some general guidelines that we use from a dietary recommendation as to how to reduce cardiovascular problems and hopefully reduce the incidence of cancer.
Every place I go, I mention the name Dr. Kenneth Cooper, and everyone knows the man for good reason. Not only does he have the Cooper Clinic in Texas, but also he's written many national best-selling books, like Aerobics in 1968, New Aerobics in 1970. Boy, I have to go way down the line. I mean, he's got about 8 different books here. Is there a book that we can find on the shelves these days, Dr. Kenneth Cooper, that's popular?
Yes, a lot of my books are still selling very well. In fact,
backlist,
Controlling
huh?
Cholesterol, that was published in 1988, just went through its 1 millionth copy in print.
My goodness.
And that's doing real well. But my prime all-time best-selling book is The Aerobics Program for Total Well-Being, published in 1982. And that's still available on the shelves. And even Aerobics, published in 1968, is still available. That's done very well. My latest book, though, and that was number 11, and that was published in August of this year, and that's Kid Fitness. It's getting a lot of good publicity this time of the year because we're finding that families are buying it for their children. I'm talking about older parents buying it for their adult children who have young children, because this book, Kid Fitness, was actually written for adults, not for the kids, but to give them guidelines as to what they should do from birth to 17 in being sure those kids are properly fed and properly exercised. But that's my latest book.
And exercise is a big part as far as kids. If you were, you know, we have a lot of discussion these days about the couch potato children, the fat children, the children with high blood pressure, high cholesterol, atherosclerosis already developing in the arteries. Let me ask you, which is the chicken and the egg, so to speak, and that's probably a bad analogy. I mean, is it the fact that these kids are poorly nourished and therefore they don't want to go out and exercise, or is it the fact that they're lazy and just sit around and watch TV and eat junk food, or is it just a combination of the two?
Well, I think it's a combination of both, but it certainly begins early, I can assure you. In fact, a study was done back in 1990 in the JMA on blood pressure, fitness, and fatness in 5- and 6-year-old children from the inner city area in New York City. 216 Hispanic kids were checked, and as you would predict, there was a perfect correlation between fatness and fitness, and fatness and lack of fitness and blood pressure. And the points made in that article I thought were excellent. Number one, these 5 and 6 year old kids, that habits formed early in life may become permanent. That's one thing you have to worry. The second thing is that early behavior pattern may influence their physical activity the rest of their life. You have these kids that are fat at 5 and 6 years of age, and they are rejected by their peers. They become the wallflowers. They are not selected to participate in activities with their other kids, and so they develop a very negative attitude towards exercise, even at a very early age. It's a psychological thing. And the third point they make is, you mentioned earlier, it's not uncommon to find children killed accidentally, 8, 10, 12 years of age, who have cholesterol streaking in their major arteries. And after going through puberty, it's not uncommon to find early arteriosclerotic changes in the coronary arteries, even as kids as young as 14, 15 years of age. So I think a lot of this is genetic to some extent, but most of it's environmental. And it's the fact that 40 cents of every dollar spent eating out in this country is spent at a fast food restaurant. And as you and I know, the level of cholesterol and the fats in those foods is enormous. And I think it's diet that relates to our physical activity of our kids. I think it's lack of PE programs in our school systems. It's the lack of the kids not walking or riding their bicycle to schools like they used to. All these things are factors.
So how would you advise parents if they see their kids going down the wrong track? How would you advise parents to start straightening things out?
Well, the first thing, we go right back to our basic component parts of a fitness program, and that's evaluation. Evaluation very commonly motivates. That's number two. And along with motivation, add education. And then number three is implementation, properly, safely. And then number four is reevaluation. And we've done this, John, with our Fitness Gram, which is a national test of the fitness of American youth from K through 12. It's now sponsored by the Prudential Life Insurance Company. We already have over 3 million kids involved in this program. And if people want to just contact their local Prudential office, they'll get them set up with this program. It doesn't cost them anything, particularly for the schools. But this is a test of the strength, the flexibility, and the endurance capacity of American youth from K through 12. And then it sends a report card home, a fitness gram, a report card home to the parents. And the parents can see how their child compares with other children the same age and the same sex. I've done that in my book. If they buy a copy of the kids' fitness book, the fitness gram is in the book. So I'm saying there's a way to assess the child. The parent can assess the child as far as their nutritional evaluation is concerned. They can assess their habits. They can assess the child as far as their exercise habits are concerned. And that's the first step. And you'd be amazed. Once that child finds his or her level of fitness or nutritional deficiencies, how many times they'll correct that on their own. We did a study back in 1986 on 17,000 school children. We evaluated them at the beginning of the year and did nothing to change their habits during the year, but reevaluated at the end of the year. And in every parameter we tested in that experimental group, they actually improved all five categories that we test for fitness, flexibility, and endurance capacity. They increased in 1 year merely because they were tested at the beginning of the year. Evaluation is so important from a motivational standpoint, and then equally as important is reevaluate to determine their progress. And I've gone over that in great detail in Kid Fitness. And the listening audience, by contacting the local Prudential Life Insurance office, they get information on the Prudential Fitness Gram that is available all over the country now.
Dr. Kenneth Cooper, how about parents taking the children into laboratories and getting blood cholesterol levels done? What age, and do you think it's a good idea?
Well, I talk about that in my book on kids' fitness, and I also my book on cholesterol. And if there is a strong family history of heart disease, that is, people dying or having heart attacks less than 50 years of age, particularly well men or women, or if there's a strong history of a high cholesterol among family members, I strongly believe that that child less than 5 years of age should at least have a finger stick in the total cholesterol measured. Now, I would like every child pre-puberty to have a lipid profile. Now, that means the cholesterol, an HDL cholesterol, an LDL cholesterol, the ratio, and the triglycerides, the five things that make up a lipid profile. It'd be fantastic if every child in this country before puberty could have that test done. We now have shopping malls that can do that. We have the fingerstick capabilities that can do that. Now, it costs a little money, but not much. I would like for all the children, the parents to know their children up to puberty, just what is their lipid profile, because we can make changes in it. As we mentioned earlier, I mean, those cholesterol deposits building up in these puberty kids and their arteries, that wasn't by happenstance. That's because of their cholesterol buildup, because of their diet. Remember that heart disease is characterized by years and years of incubation and by seconds of a terminal event. That starts early, pre-puberty. Let's diagnose the problem. Let's get it corrected early. Let's save lives that way.
But the disease is so common that you can almost make the assumption if your family's eating the rich American diet, it's time to change.
We talk about at 25 years of age for the average American male. We don't take it, talk in terms of prevention. We talk in terms of rehabilitation. Because already we find so many. Look at the American casualties killed in Korea. Look at the American casualties killed in Vietnam. Incomparable studies showed in Korea almost 70% of those men already had some signs of coronary disease, and that was at age 22. They didn't believe that, so the study was repeated in Vietnam, published in 1973 by McNamara, and they showed 55% of the young men killed in Vietnam, average age 22 years, already had signs of coronary artery disease. No, it's safe to assume that the average American, 20, 25 years of age, particularly the men, already have some signs of coronary disease. So we have to think, unfortunately, we have to think in terms of rehabilitation rather than prevention at that age.
So you have the message from Dr. Kenneth Cooper. It's time to make dietary and lifestyle changes. People ask me all the time. In fact, they don't just ask me. They tell me. They say exercise lowers cholesterol. What do you think?
No, without changes in diet, I wouldn't expect any significant decrease in the total cholesterol, but we do see almost consistently an increase in the good HDL cholesterol in response to exercise. So I would say this, that exercise improves your coronary risk, not specifically by lowering the cholesterol, but by improving your ratio. Now remember, the total cholesterol HDL ratio is probably the best atherogenic index. What that means is that's the best index of what's happening in your coronary arteries or your arteries in general right now. That ratio should be less than 4.5 in a man, less than 4 in a woman. Now, recent studies, particularly the studies out of Seattle by Greg Brown, have indicated that if you can get that ratio down to around 2.5 or less, that you might be actually able to reverse arterial sclerosis, actually dissolve some of those deposits, if you get the ratio down to less than 2.5 or the LDL cholesterol down to less than 125. All right, where does exercise fit in? We know that the higher the HDL cholesterol, the better, because the HDL cholesterol is provided to do two things. Number one, it somehow interacts with the LDL or bad cholesterol and keeps it from depositing along the vessel wall. And secondly, that's probably the Roto-Rooter. That's probably the substance which is responsible for dissolving plaques or dissolving cholesterol deposits. So the higher the better. We know that in men it must be above 45 to be considered normal, and women above 55. That's one reason women have one-tenth the incidence of heart disease that men have until they go through the menopause, because they have the higher protective HDL or good cholesterol. We know that aerobic exercise, not weight training or muscle building, but aerobic exercise almost always, not always, but almost always does significantly increase the HDL cholesterol. So that's where exercise helps as far as cholesterol is concerned.
So it's important, and it goes hand in hand, good exercise and also a good diet. This is Dr. John McDougall on KSRO Radio with Dr. Kenneth Cooper, and let's take a call from Frank. Hello, Frank. You're on the air with Dr. Cooper.
Hi, Dr. Cooper. Thanks a lot for all you've been doing all these years. I first was reading about you, as I sat in a chair recuperating from a bypass, since I didn't know about nutrition and exercise at that point. I've got a question. How far along are we, do you know? And is your, are you doing anything in regard to trying to get insurance coverage for programs like yours and Dr. McDougall's?
Well, for a good question, Frank, and I love to ask the insurance companies that provide the health insurance. You guys providing health insurance or disease insurance? They're providing disease insurance because they invariably tell me that their insurance policy doesn't cover what I do here. Let me happily say that is changing. And I've fought this for 20 years, Frank. But I was delighted to see recently that Blue Cross Blue Shield has taken a major step, and they're now allowing some 12 different preventive medicine things that we utilize to be covered by the health insurance. So it's been a long time in coming, still isn't there yet, but the health insurance, quote-unquote health insurance carriers, are beginning to look at what we're doing and seeing some value to it. So we're going to keep working on that.
The other thing was that I believe it was in your book, Aerobic Way, you outlined the fact that in West Germany, I think you wrote that book in 78 or something like that, you referred to, I think it was 25 facilities in West Germany at that time, that where people would come for 4 weeks if they had risk factors and 6 weeks if they actually had a heart incident.
That's correct. Those are called cardiac clinics in West Germany.
Now, as I understand it, the folks who have the brains to design the Mercedes and BMW saw the economic viability of paying a few thousand dollars to go to a place like yours or Dr. McDougall's rather than pay the current $40,000 or whatever for a bypass. And I'm just puzzled if we've had 20. I've asked many, many people if they're familiar with the West Germany experience and the stats or anything on it, and it's like a It's almost like a cover-up. Nobody seems to know about it. And
they
I'm just curious about that.
They aren't quite as sophisticated. I was in Germany in early October this year. I get on a consultant visit. I go there all the time. I've worked with their Minister of Health and Research. That's the equivalent of Health and Human Services Secretary in West Germany. So I know pretty well what's happening over there. Unfortunately, Frank, the cardiac clinics were set aside for the employee who for some reason was not producing at his or her highest efficiency. And they really had a labor problem over there, not having enough skilled people to work in their auto plants and all of that. So they would send these people away for 4 to 6 weeks, as I described in the aerobics way, and it really would rejuvenate them. But it was more rest and relaxation than it was really sophisticated preventive or rehabilitative medicine. Now they want to go the next step, and that's the reason I'm working with them. They want to get away from the mud baths and the massages into really the changing the diets, the sophisticated exercise, sophisticated diagnostic techniques, and that's the reason I was in Erlsen, Germany in early October of this year. So the Germans have their heart set properly as far as trying to prevent disease, but they're a little bit behind as far as the modern technology and what they can do both in diagnostic and preventive cardiology. But they're interested, and I'm happy to say I'm working with them, and we hope to be opening a good sophisticated center comparable to ours about 200 kilometers north of Frankfurt and within the next year.
So in that previous period, they weren't focusing so much on helping people get their fat percentage down and the cholesterol and so forth?
It was kind of pathetic. I actually visited a cardiac clinic in Munich around, it must have been the early 1970s, and that's why I wrote about it in 78. And I wasn't impressed then. And the sophistication of their diagnostic procedures was antiquated. The dietary approach, as I said, it was designed basically for just rest and relaxation. But even with that, you get those employees away for 4 to 6 weeks out of the stress of their environment, let them kind of unwind, and they had some very low-grade exercise programs. They had some very low-grade nutritional programs, but they nearly all improved. So again, we found in our studies, it doesn't take a fantastic change in lifestyle to get significant improvements in this area. And that's what was happening in the early stages of the cardiac clinics in Western Germany. But they want to become more experienced, more advanced, like we are now, and that's the reason we're trying to work with them.
So there's the future, Frank.
Okay, well, thanks very
much.
I had one other, but I don't want to hog the thing.
Well,
I guess there's other people.
Make it quick.
Very quick. Is there any way that, or is there something now that shows like a consolidated approach of all of the different programs? Because there are differences, and as you pointed out, your approach you feel is more practical than Pritikin's, but it's not clear whether you feel that if you had your choice, that people, it would be better to go a Pritikin or even one step farther to the McDougall approach, and whether that would really be better, but from a practical standpoint, it's better to start out at a lower stage, or how that works. I get confused.
I understand the question. I think it's a really good one, Frank.
I'm not quite sure I can give you the answer, because there's different ways to invent the wheel, you might say. But we're not trying to reinvent it. We're just trying to improve upon it, and all these different approaches are being used. But I'd say, Frank, that our approach is very practical. Our approach has to be designed to the business executive who is flying on airplanes 2 or 3 days a week, who's living out of hotels. So we try to give people realistic approaches that we know we can get some results if they'll follow. I think that's probably the difference in orientation between the three different organizations that you mentioned. But I hope that ours is something that people can live with, and I'm sure that John's is the same way.
Well, the important thing is they're all heading in the same direction, and thank you for calling,
Thanks,
Frank.
Thanks a lot.
Hello.
Hello.
You're on the air with Dr. Kenneth Cooper.
Yes. Well, Mr. Cooper, it was interesting that you're on the air today, because just yesterday, I'm in an aerobic, a body conditioning class at Santa Rosa Junior College here, and it just happened our teacher was talking about you yesterday, and it's interesting you're on the air today.
I appreciate that.
And so I guess my question is for you is, I find it very interesting, but all I've been doing in the body conditioning classes because of my cerebral palsy is I don't do a lot of the running part of the exercises, as he has his run around the track and stuff, but I do the indoor stuff, you know, that he has us do. Have you done any programs with people with special needs, like disabled or physical disabilities?
Yeah, we have a lot of people in that category, everywhere from cardiac rehabilitation programs that meet every morning here at the aerobic center to people with muscular problems, cerebral palsy included, from swimming programs to using exercises strictly with the arms, just to the legs. We have about 100 different pieces of exercise equipment here at our aerobics activity center, which is our health club. And we have a lot of people who are physically handicapped who are working those programs. We have individual trainers that work with them. We're very interested in that.
Fantastic. Now, where is your actual center for that? Is that here in Santa Rosa, or is it?
Oh, no. The only center we have is here in Dallas.
In Dallas,
we supervise it. And it's combined. It's five different organizations, including our clinic, the Cooper Clinic, and then the Aerobics Activity Center, Well, well over 1,000 people exercise here every day, and a lot of those people are handicapped.
Fantastic.
Is the 800 number still 444-5764?
For the center here in Dallas?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't have that committed in memory. I can look it up real quick.
Well, I have it right here on your letterhead, if that's that's accurate. So you can call 1-800-444-5764 if you'd like to have more information on the Cooper Clinic and what it has to offer. Does that cover it for you, Andre?
Well, the other thing is I want to know, has he written any books that I can go out and buy to kind of help me follow some kind of a program, unless you, Dr. McDougal, know of a place here in Santa Rosa that I can go to get further help after the junior college.
I would think Dr. Kenneth Cooper probably is the expert in the country and possibly the world on this, so you're talking to the right person right now.
Okay. And about any book that might apply for your particular circumstance, I haven't written a book strictly for people with muscular deficiencies or problems, but I have modified my programs and the aerobics program for total well-being for people with everything from severe cardiovascular problems, they can barely exercise, to people following bypass surgery, etc. And some of those could be adapted. Remember, there are 31 exercises listed, or different ways you can exercise. This is the aerobics program for total well-being that are aerobic. And a lot of those can be done by people that are handicapped.
Okay.
And you can still get the aerobic benefit, regardless of what you do. And our recent studies, Andrea, show amazingly how little exercise is necessary to get substantial benefit. In essence, you just avoid inactivity. So again, there's a lot of benefit. Great return on your investment if you just avoid inactivity. And certainly in the aerobics program of total well-being, there are programs there that you could follow, even with CP, and expect to get some good results.
Okay. One more question, and I'll let someone else on the line have it. Have you found that when working with people who have epilepsy, that the more aerobics they do, and as our teacher tells us, the more air that you get into your body, do you find that kind of helps the nervous system to keep them from having more epileptic seizures, even though they should stay on their medication and stuff like that? Do you find that?
Well, I wish I could answer that question. I really can't document that, Andrew, that there has been any improvement in epilepsy or seizures in response to aerobic conditioning. I would strongly encourage those people who are listening to have epilepsy by all means to stay on their medications. Exercise is certainly of value to these people. I just spoke with a young woman yesterday who's finished a half marathon, and she's an epileptic and takes medications and doing extremely well. Now, is her aerobic conditioning reducing the frequency of her epilepsy to the extent she shouldn't take medication? Not in a million years would I tell that woman to go off medication. But still, I can't answer your question. I don't think anybody can.
Okay.
Well, thank you for calling, Andre.
All righty.
This is Dr. John McDougall on KSRO Radio 1350. My guest is Dr. Kenneth Cooper, and he has many books out. The latest one is Kid Fitness. Dr. Cooper, you talk about aerobic exercise and anaerobic exercise, and there's been great controversy as to how much exercise you should get, what kind of exercise you should get. I mean, there was a time when it was no pain, no gain, and now people are trying to tell me that all you have to do is exercise at a moderate level. As a matter of fact, it may be better for you to do a moderate exercise 3 times a week, 5 times a week. What is your recommendation?
Well, John, a lot of this has been suspect over the years because most of the data in the scientific literature has not really been objectively determined. That it's been based on questionnaires. There's been a lot of fallacies and deficiencies in the studies. That's why I think that the article we published in November 1989 has been classified as a landmark study of the century, answering the question how much exercise is necessary if your goals are health and longevity. And that was a study of 13,400 healthy men and women followed for an average of 8.2 years. We looked at their measured levels of fitness by the time on the treadmill and correlated it with the presence or absence of disease and particularly all types of mortality. And that's the thing that's really started what you might call the controversy over the past couple of years, because in that article we're able to show that you can exercise for fitness and you can exercise for health and longevity, and they aren't one and the same. Plus the fact you can be aerobically fit and meet all of our standards for being aerobically fit vis-a-vis Jim Fix and still not be healthy. He had severe far advanced coronary disease, as most of the American public knows, when he died back in 1984. Right, to the contrary, though, you can exercise enough to get a substantial reduction in all-risk mortality by just merely avoiding inactivity. What am I talking about? Our studies showed that looking at men, all causes of mortality, and classifying them into 5 fitness groups, the bottom 20 percentile to the top 20 percentile. Now, the drop-off in all causes of death, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, even deaths from cancer, were directly related. That if you draw it from Category 1, the very poorest level of fitness, to Category 5, the very top level of fitness, the drop-off was 65%, which translates to a 3-year increase in longevity. But the surprising thing in the study, John, was you got the greatest part of that 65% by just moving up one block on the 5-block scale. That is, if you move from block one, the lowest category of fitness, just up one block, the next 20%, you got 55, the total 65%. And that moving up one block translates to walking 2 miles in 30 minutes three times a week. That translates to getting 15 to 18 aerobic points per week, not 30 to 35 points a week minimum that's necessary for aerobic fitness. So I think we have answers now that we didn't have before. And that study we published in 1989 was so successful, it hit the front page of our major newspaper in America. It was published as a lead article in the JMA. And also NIH, John, gave us $1.6 million to continue our research in that area. And our study coming out next year will deal with 57,000 patients, over 300,000 first years of follow-up, and we're showing the same thing. So again, if you want to exercise and extend your life by the 2.5 years and reduce deaths from heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, and even deaths from cancer by 55%, you walk 2 miles in 30 minutes three times a week. For the older audience listening to us, 2 miles in 40 minutes, 220-minute miles, five times a week, or even go out and walk 3 miles in 45 minutes twice a week, or go through 2 45-minute aerobic exercise classes per week. All those give you 15 to 18 aerobic points, and that's enough to substantially reduce all causes of death.
Well, Dr. Kenneth, you're taking our excuses away from us, Dr. Kenneth Cooper. I mean, you know, when you make it so simple, so practical, so within the time constraints of our busy lives, then we've got no reason to say we can't exercise.
Well, you know, when Papenberg, it came out with a Harvard alumni study, published in the New England Journal back in the early 80s, and he showed from evaluating those 16,000 Harvard alumni that you had to expend about 2,000 calories of energy per week exercising to get a 2.4-year extension onto your life. But the Harvard alumni study had a major problem in it. They didn't measure fitness. They asked people what they did. They sent them questionnaires. And Ralph knew that well, so he joined us in our study as a co-author of our study we published at JMA, and says that our data is so vastly superior to Harvard alumni study, looking at exercise and health, because we actually measured fitness. So again, he said that you have to expend 2,000 calories per week. That translates to running 20 miles a week. People aren't going to do that. But to the contrary, I'm saying if you walk 2 miles in 30 minutes three times a week, or 2 miles in 40 minutes five times a week, and you get that much return on your investment, can you afford not to exercise? As you said, what is your excuse?
You're out of excuses. You got to be healthy. This is Dr. John McDougall on KSRO Radio 1350. I'm with Dr. Ken Cooper, and let's take a call. We've got Frank on the line. Hello, Frank.
Yeah, I have a question. I've been listening to you, Dr. McDougall, for quite a while, and got a lot of good information from you. And Kenneth Cooper, I got your book way back in 1970.
Great.
And I know you've updated it since. I have a question concerning indoor bicycle. I ride an indoor bicycle, and I can't seem to get my pulse rate up beyond about 20 points over what my normal pulse rate is. My pulse rate generally is around 60. I'm 55 years old almost, and I get it up to 80.
How old are you?
55.
Okay.
And I get it up to 80, and you know, I can't seem to, you know, get it up real higher. And you know, I could probably put a real pressure on the bicycle, but you know, it doesn't seem like that's a natural way. I'm pumping pretty hard at 80.
Are you taking medication?
No, I'm not. I have slight raised blood pressure, but not that high. About 5 points over.
You're not taking medication for your blood pressure?
No, I'm not.
A beta blocker?
Not at this time. No medication whatsoever.
Okay, Frank, I'd strongly recommend that you have a stress test performed by someone in your area just to make sure that your heart rate response is normal, because that is most unusual unless you're taking a medication such as a beta blocker to treat heart disease or high blood pressure.
Uh-huh.
Because certainly your heart rate should go higher than 80, otherwise that you're not going to have much of a training effect either from health and longevity or from a fitness standpoint.
Uh-huh.
Now, the thing that you might be making a mistake, though, is that you're checking your pulse rate when you finish. Is that correct?
You know, no, I actually I do it when I'm riding.
Now, can you accurately check it while you're riding?
Yeah, I hold my hand right on my wrist, and I check it, and I sometimes go through the whole minute, you know, just to see. Now,
okay, because it is pretty hard to check it accurately, and that's why for our patients that really want to exercise in a sophisticated fashion, make sure they're getting aerobic benefit,
mm-hmm.
we encourage them to get a heart rate monitor. And about the only one that works accurately is this one that goes around the chest and then it radios an impulse to the wrist. You have a big watch on your wrist and you can read it. And those work real well. Those are very accurate, about the only ones. But that we found in many cases, too, in which people are checking their heart rate during the exercise, they're way off.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, if they wait until the exercise is over and then they wait till the second hand gets just right and count for 10 seconds multiplied by 6, usually you can add about 15 beats per minute onto that because the heart rate drops so rapidly once you finish exercising. But I would really question the accuracy of your heart rate being only 80 if you're exercising fairly vigorously.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is, if that is correct, then you really should be evaluated because that's not a normal response.
Okay. Well, that's what I wanted to know.
And I'd second that, too. You need to get an evaluation by a doctor who's familiar with this, Frank. And thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
21 years of experience, Dr. Kenneth Cooper. Tell me, is disease reversible? Is diabetes reversible? High blood pressure reversible? Atherosclerosis reversible? I mean, here you're looking at people who are 40, 50, 60, 70 years old, and they say, prevention sounds great, but you missed the boat. My mother never told me about this. Now I'm in trouble. What can I do?
Then all three things that you mentioned, atherosclerosis, high blood pressure, and diabetes, particularly adult onset diabetes, by and large, are reversible by losing weight, changing your diet, starting the exercise programs. But, you know, I'm almost 61 now, finishing 32 years of regular exercise. I'm just passing 25,000 miles of running this month, in fact.
Wow.
25,000 miles once around the world. And people ask me, since we've documented with our studies, that all you have to do is just run, walk 2 miles in 30 minutes three times a week. They really get the health and longevity benefits. Am I going to cut back from my 12, 15 miles of running per week that I've been doing for 32 years? And my answer is no. Because, you see, I don't exercise just for health and longevity. I exercise for quality of life. There's no way I can look forward to going skiing here between Christmas and New Year's for 5 and 6 hours a day, if it's 60 years of age, if I don't keep myself fit, not just healthy. Also, there's no way, John, that I can look forward to squaring off the curve when I die. That's the goal of gerontologists, to live healthy lives up until that last moment and then die suddenly. We call it squaring off the curve.
I like that.
And the best way to do that is to enter advanced years healthy, physically fit, active, and you can condense the time of senility and senescence into a short period immediately prior to death. And look what the U.S. Public Health Service said in October this year in their prevention reports. They pointed out that the average lifespan of an American in 1980 was 74 years, but the average useful life expectancy was 62 years. That is, we have the last 12 years of our life just existing. We become dependent, and we've lost quality. I don't want that. I want to enjoy life up until the final moment, and that's why I hear exactly the concepts we've been talking about for the last hour.
You've given me great inspiration. I'm sure my listeners are just as inspired, Dr. Kenneth Cooper, and I appreciate you sharing your time with us, and just as you have with the people around the country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. It's my pleasure.